ninth floor, right as you come off the elevator to your right. Okay. I saw that most of you have picked up your quizzes. So if you haven't, they're still out there, and they will be till Friday, at which point I'll bring them into my office. So about 10 leftover first quizzes. There'll probably be about 10 leftover second quizzes. It's usually the same people who don't pick up both quizzes. So I know where that's going. So I'll end up with all three of your quizzes and your final exam, and what you don't see, I guess, doesn't happen. Right? So it's a twist on the world, but if you can't, do pick up the quizzes. So today we're going to continue our discussion of P/E ratio. So if you remember the foundations we laid, we went back to a dividend discount model. Sounded like, you know, we're going backwards because we're doing a relative valuation, but we used the dividend discount model to come up with the three variables that drive P/E ratios. So let me remind you what they are again. Expected growth in earnings. The higher that number, the higher the P/E. Second, the riskiness of your equity, captured in your cost of equity. The higher the risk, the lower the P/E. And the third is the return on equity slash payout. And the higher the return on equity for any given growth rate, the higher the P/E. We said the perfect cheap stock is one which has a low P/E, a high growth rate, a low risk, and a high return on equity. I want you to hold on to that because today you're going to play the fun game of picking apart recommendations I'm going to make to you. So I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to be market strategist, and I'm going to be an equity analyst. I'm going to put out buy recommendations, sell recommendations, all based on P/E. And I want you to tell me what I'm missing with each one. Okay? Before I do that, though, let's start with using what we've learned about P/Es to kind of dispel some very widely used rules of thumb in markets. So here's the first one. P/E ratio for the S&P 500 is high. Whether it's 20 or 21 or 19, depends on whether you're using trailing earnings or forward earnings, all kinds of stuff. But it's high. High relative to what? High relative to what it's been for the last 25 or 30 years. In fact, Shiller has a normalized P/E. It's around 17, and this number is at 20. So you can use every variation. I'll concede up front. P/E ratios today are higher than they've been historically. That's a fact. Let's not debate that. Now, let me throw, it could mean, of course, that stocks are overvalued, which is the leap that most people seem to make right after they make that comparison. P/E ratios are high, therefore stocks must be overvalued. But let me throw some potential reasons for you, and you tell me whether this reason works in the right direction. Some will work, some will not. Could it be that the risk-free rate is at a historic low? Do you think that affects the PE? In fact, let me ask you a very simplistic question. If you have a risk-free investment right now, let's make it a long-term risk-free investment. What PE ratio should you have on a risk-free investment? Let's make it risk-free, growth-free. PE ratio 1? If you're going to make that forever, because it's you know, risk-free investment essentially continues in perpetuity, what should you be willing to pay for it? Risk-free rate right now is what? It's the inverse of the risk-free rate. So basically right now the PE ratio for a risk-free investment should be 50, which is actually an issue we have to think about, because you know where it shows up? The PE ratio for Apple is actually a weighted average of the PE ratio for being in smartphones, computers, etc., and the PE ratio for cash. It's almost going to act like a magnet pulling up the PE ratios for companies, because if you have a lot of cash, that cash should be trading at a huge multiple of earnings, because those earnings are so low. So when risk-free rates go down, it's almost a given that PE ratios are going to go up. It doesn't mean stocks are overvalued. It's because the expected return you need to make on stocks is much lower when you have a 1% risk-free rate than when you have an 8% risk-free rate, right? And in fact, there is a reason PE ratios got to 6 or 7 in the 1970s, is risk-free rates got to 12%. When risk-free rate is 12%, your expected return on equity is going to be 17 or 18%, which means you're going to demand a much higher earnings for any given price. So that could be one possible explanation. I'm not saying it is. We'll come back and look at whether it explains away the PE ratio, but at least it'll give you a sense of direction. That makes sense. Pushes up the PE. Could it be that the equity risk premium today is much higher than it's been historically? Does this work in the right direction?
No.
It doesn't. In fact, equity risk premiums going up will actually push down stock prices. Could it be that the return on equity is higher than it's been historically? You think that plays a, does it affect PE? Indirectly it does, right? Because a higher return on equity means that your growth is more efficient. If the growth is more efficient, the same growth rate should deliver a higher PE. I'd be a little cautious about return on equity because it's an accounting number. You know why we should be cautious? Because you could have a high return on equity not because you're taking great projects, but because you're buying back stock and shrinking your book equity. But if your true return on equity on projects is going up, it will show up as a higher PE ratio. And if expected earnings growth is going to be higher, that too could explain it. I'm not saying any of these explain it away. I'm saying it's a complicated game. You can't just compare the PE ratio today to what it's been historically. You have to find a way to bring in these other variables before you pass judgment. So the next time you open up the journal article about PE ratios being higher than historic norms, as the if the author makes that leap from that to, hey, there's a bubble, stop and say, wait, we can't make that leap yet until we've dotted our I's and crossed our T's. Bubble is a word of desperation. It basically means I've given up trying to explain things. It's all these crazy, irrational people around me who are driving prices. So basically, I'm going to call it a bubble. So use the word bubble once you've gone through the reasons. But it should be the last word you use, not the first word. Because if it's the first word you use, you never ask the question, could there be something else explaining what's going on? Another example. Let's suppose I come to you with two stocks. First stock has a PE ratio of 20. The second stock has a PE ratio of 10. You think this is easy? I'll pick the one with 10. But the first stock has a growth rate of 10%, and the second stock has a growth rate of 5%. So I ask you to pick between the two stocks. So I'm going to ask for some choices. How many would pick B because it has a lower? So if you were to pick cheap or expensive based on the data that I've given you, how many would pick B because it has a lower P? Nobody? And you can see why, right? Lower P but the lower growth. You won't pick A either because it's a higher P, higher growth. In fact, what's the shortcut analysts use to deal with the fact that different companies have different growth rates? They actually compute a composite ratio where they take the PE and divide by the growth rate. You're saying, what the heck does that give you? I have no idea, but let's call it a PEG ratio, which is price earnings divided by growth. And the PEG ratio of a company A is 2, and the PEG ratio of a company B is 2. I'm going to talk about it. I think this is the worst multiple ever concocted, in my view. And I'll talk about why it should scare the living daylights out of you when you use it. But you can see the logic, at least, that drove them there, right? They're saying, I have different companies in my sector. Some have low growth, some have high growth. I can't compare the P/E ratios. I'm going to divide the growth rate by the P/E ratio by the growth rate to come up with this. And I'll give you an opening. When I do that, I mean, every time you do something in relative valuation, you're making a statistical or a mathematical judgment. You know what you're assuming? That as growth doubles, P/E ratios also should double, right? In other words, you're assuming growth and P/E move in linear proportion. They move together. And you're going to see very quickly when you start graphing out value against growth that the relationship is not linear. And as a consequence, you're going to bias yourself against certain kinds of companies when you use PEG ratios. And we'll identify what those companies are. So that's the framework we're going to use. Every time I throw an example at you, go back to basics. Growth, risk, return on equity. I'll wager, as you go through, you're going to find very quickly how easy it is to be devil's advocate. And that's good, because you have to be devil's advocate on your own recommendations. This is the way to do it. Okay? So let's go back to our notes. I think we were on page 28. So here's my first job. I've become the asset allocation analyst for a global fund manager. So I tell the guy which countries to invest in, which countries to not. And I'm going to put you back in time because it's, and you can actually update this example if you want. I'll actually send you the updated numbers if you want. This is June of 2000. I'm trying to decide where to invest my fund's money. So those are the countries. These are all emerging markets. I'm an emerging market fund manager. Those are the P/E ratios across the markets. You're saying, this is good, I'm done. If I just pick based on PE, it's no contest, right? All my money should go into Turkey and Malaysia, and none of it should go into Singapore or South Korea or Chile. So you can see some countries have low PEs. To help you out, though, because remember, PE is affected by growth and risk and return on equity, I collected some information from these countries. There are the interest rates in each of these countries at the time that I did this, and you can see interest rates can affect PE ratios. There's a real growth in each country, and I've come up with a numerical measure of country risk. In fact, this comes from those PRS scores, the scores, and the way to read this is the lower the score, the safer a country. The higher the score, the riskier the country. So according to the score, Singapore is the safest country in this list, and the riskiest is up there. It could be Indonesia, you know, so basically Pakistan, Peru, etc. So before we even look at the numbers, you can, if you look at the PE, you say, I want low PE, but you also want high growth, low interest rates, and low country risk, right? You can already see the problem with trying to eyeball the data. You're going to get really dizzy really fast. There are some countries, there's something off with every country. Everything is not synced up for any country. So here's what I'm going to do. Rather than try to construct some rule of thumb or trying to eyeball the data, I'm going to open up my statistics book to the chapter on multiple regressions. Remember that chapter? In a multiple regression, what are you trying to do? You have a dependent variable you're trying to explain, and you have all these independent variables that you worry about. What's the variable that I'm trying to explain? P/E ratios across countries, right? What are the variables that I'm worried about? I'm worried about interest rates, I'm worried about growth, and I'm worried about risk. I'm sick of worrying, so here's what I do. I run the regression. And here's what I get as the output from the regression. First, the R-squared is high, but that's a little deceptive. It's a small sample, three variables, so it's not the R-squared is not the big. I'm looking at the coefficients I'm getting on each of the variables. So in each one, before you look at the coefficients, I'm going to ask you for a sense of direction. So I'm looking across these countries. As interest rates go up, what should happen to PEs? They should go down, so at least I'm getting confirmation. Every 1% increase in interest rates lowers my PE by 0.0794. As growth goes up, that's good, right? Because I'm getting growth, my PE ratio goes up. And as country risk increases, for any given growth rate, I should be willing to pay a lower PE for any country. So that's good news. Regressions don't always deliver good news. Sometimes the coefficients will have the wrong signs. You can't control that. At least here, the signs are all consistent. The R-squared is not bad. Joseph.
Sorry. Could you just go over the intuition why interest rates, the way in which interest
Well, interest rates affect my, if you think about it, it's a risk-free rate that goes into my cost of equity, right? So if I have a higher risk-free rate, my cost of equity becomes a higher number. If my cost of equity becomes, for any given nominal growth rate, because remember, these are nominal growth rates. If you have high interest rates, it also means that a big chunk of your growth rate is going to become inflation-driven, which effectively then translates into a lower P/E ratio. Okay. So that's the intuition. It doesn't, again, always work. It's a big difference in interest rates. That's when you're going to notice it. Now, why am I doing this? Because I want to decide which countries to invest in and which not to, right? You're saying, how does this help me? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take each country. So in this example, for instance, I'm going to take Argentina, 18% interest rate, 2.5% real growth, 45 country risk, plug it in. When I plug the numbers in, I'll get a predicted PE for Argentina. And the predicted PE I get is 13.5. So you say, what the heck does that even mean? Given how these countries are being priced, and given Argentina's specific characteristics, its high interest rates, its low real growth, its high country risk, I would expect the PE ratio to be 13.57. It's actually 14. So does it make Argentina overvalued or undervalued? It's overvalued by not that much, by like 3%. You think this is a lot of work for very little. I do that for the next country. In fact, I do the predicted PEs for every country. And what I'm looking for are countries where the actual PE is much lower than my predicted PE, the biggest percentage differences. So Turkey looks really cheap, but its predicted PE is also really low. So I'm looking for mismatches. In this case, I think if you look at the mismatches, there are a couple, I think, that Hong Kong came through. And Hong Kong is about 15% below. So you can rank them based on percentage differences. But there are a couple of things to keep in mind. I've run a regression, and it's a linear regression, right? And we know, again, that might not be the case. When you hear about people building quant models, that's what then happens, is you take this regression, you refine it, and you build in non-linearities, you bring in more data. But the end game is you want to come up with a predictive equation that takes all the things that you worry about qualitatively and says, let me put them into the numbers and see what the price should be. So rather than comparing PEs across countries, you're comparing the PE of each country against a predicted value. Today, you can do this across countries, and you have a lot more data on every country. You can get political risk measures. You can get all kinds of corruption indices. You can throw them all. See if it matters. Do tax rates matter? Does corruption matter? Does political risk matter? Does fear of nationalization matter? Does legal system matter? Throw them all in and see if you can come up with ways of explaining differences in multiples across countries with the end game of saying, I want to buy a country that's selling for less than I would expect it to, given all these worries. So you're not avoiding the risky countries, you're just avoiding the countries which are risky, but the price doesn't reflect that.
So if we're trying to figure out the relevance of like a corruption index, would we throw it into this equation
yeah.
and see if the R squared goes up?
Exactly, or the coefficient. It's a standard, it's data. That's a way to think about it. Don't even think of it anything other than data. The problem here, though, is when you run a multiple regression, remember that other thing that statistics throws into the mix that makes it a little difficult? What's supposed to be true about the relationship across the independent variables if you have a good multiple regression? They're supposed to be uncorrelated. In fact, you know, statistics professors have this big word, multicollinearity. Right? Like they use it like a demon in the closet. Oh, multicollinearity. So what the heck does that even mean? It basically means that if you have three variables that are connected to each other, it's not that the regression stops making sense, but the coefficient will stop making sense because each variable becomes a stand-in for the other. And unfortunately, in finance, you will never find three independent variables that are uncorrelated with each other. Like growth, interest rates, and country risk, I mean, those are all going to be entangled somewhere, right? So that's, I think, the statistical worry. There are fixes, statistically. You're saying, but this is not statistics. Remember what I said. Once you enter into the pricing domain, you're playing the statistics game. You're not playing the finance game. Play it well. You're playing Moneyball. You got all this data. Don't just stick with the average. Start at least bringing in the other data into making your judgments. Any questions? Yes, Nick.
For this to be meaningful in terms of why you're making the judgment, would you have to buy the market index?
This is how it will work. Remember that the way portfolio management works is there are multiple layers. There's the asset allocation layer. So we'll meet as a committee and say, we're going to put 27% of our global fund into India, 16% into Brazil, 12% into China. So that allocation decision gets made based on this. Then I have other analysts in each country who are grinding through numbers on individual companies. So I go to them and say, find me the 20 best Indian companies to put in. So what this does is it allows the asset allocation layer to be based on some pricing judgment across markets. And within each market, you can either use intrinsic valuation or pricing to decide which stocks to buy within each market. You don't have to buy the index. But if you didn't have analysts, then you have to play the index game. It's a market timing game you're playing. You're moving across markets. This is as good as any other market timing device, to be quite honest, right? Because the way most global portfolio managers market time is they chase everybody else into markets. They basically look to see where everybody else is going. They join in. This at least says, look, you know, step back and ask, why is this market trading at 8x earnings? You know? So that's essentially what we're trying to do. And the more creative you can be about bringing... So right now, for instance, you look at any country which is natural resource-based, the P/E ratios are low. And if you're not careful, you're going to be going to Australia and Canada and Russia. But when you're doing that, you're really making a bet on commodity prices coming back up. So maybe you will have a variable for the percentage of companies that are commodity companies and throw that into the regression to see if that explains why something looks cheap. Okay. So your end game is to make sure you're not going into a market that looks cheap for the wrong reasons. You're going into a market that actually looks cheap because the market screwed up. Now, I will let you deal with this. Actually, I pulled this off. I showed you there's a lot more data. This actually was price-earnings ratio. It came up with price-earnings, cyclically adjusted P/E and price-to-book by parts of the world. And I don't take this as a given. They broke the world down into the red, which is dangerous spots. Don't even go there, to green. So you can make a judgment on how they tried to decide what was cheap or expensive. But the data is there for you to draw something like that with every country. Capital IQ has data on every country. You can pull the data down and start to kind of disentangle why some countries trade at low PEs and low price-to-book ratios and see if you can come up with a reason. Yeah.
Basically saying you should buy the countries in green?
That's what they were saying.
Like Greece.
Yeah, like Greece. And this is exactly why when you just compare across multiples is exactly where you're going to end up. Is countries are going to look cheap because they trade at low multiples. If you bring in the fundamentals in, your green might look very different from their green because it might be the country that has a low PE given good growth and low political risk. You know what? With 100 countries out there, who knows? Some countries get overlooked, right? So now let's talk about the S&P 500. Most widely talked about index in the world. Every week we get at least a dozen big articles that are talked about markets, the market in a bubble. So let's start off by just looking at a couple of very simple statistics that seems to back up the bubble people. So these are actually P/E ratios across time. So I have the P/E ratio. So there's the first is the green is the P/E ratio. The second is a normalized P/E ratio. You say, what's a normalized P/E ratio? Rather than use last year's earnings, I use the average earnings over the previous 10 years. You're saying, what's that going to accomplish? Well, to the extent that earnings are cyclical, it takes into account the fact that earnings go up and down. The third measure is an inflation-adjusted earnings. The reason for that is earnings from 10 years ago, because of inflation, is really higher than it really looks. So what I do is I use the actual inflation rate. That's actually the Shiller P. It's a normalized inflation adjusted P. But with all this dancing you're doing, look at the three lines, and what do you notice? We're talking about differences in degree. They all move together. So there's nothing incredibly insightful you're going to get by moving from P to normalized P to inflation. It just looks more fancy. And on every level, you can see that the last few years, especially since 2009, you've seen P/E ratios climb. Maybe not to the level they were in the 1990s, but they've climbed. So if you look at the average P/Es across time, January 1st, 2015, this is what they look like. The actual P/E was about 18, the normalized P/E was 24, and the inflation-adjusted normalized P/E was 21.6. And those are the basis for the worries that people have right now. Are stocks overvalued? Those P/E ratios look really high relative to historic norms. And I've kind of drawn out what those norms look like depending on the slice of history you look at. So I'm going to play the role of a market strategist, and my only tool is P/E. So I look at this graph and say, oh my God, the world's going to end. Stocks are overvalued. The P/E ratio today is much higher than the P/E ratio over the last 10 years, 15, 20, so I can pick whichever time period scares you the most. I could be right. But we just looked at some of the reasons why I've got to be careful, right? Interest rates are much lower. Returns on equity might have changed. Growth rates might have changed. You know, we don't know what's going on. This is, I mean, all we're looking at is the end number. And just because I have a Nobel Prize doesn't mean that I can abandon fundamentals either. So just because Robert Shiller says, hey, the P/E ratio is high today because of it's higher than history, therefore there's a bubble, doesn't mean that you can give him a passing. You have a Nobel Prize. You don't have to ask those follow-up questions. Or I'll assume you asked them first and then came to the conclusion. Trust but verify, right? So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to take the earnings to price ratio. I'll just take the normal P because, as you can see, the three numbers. So what I've done is I've taken the PE and I've inverted it. It's called the earnings yield. I'm actually surprised that people don't use this number more often than PE because it has a very good feature. Earnings to price ratios are the inverse of the PE. But remember what happened to PE when the earnings were negative? What did we say when the PE ratio was when earnings per share were negative? That you cannot compute them, right? The reason we can't compute them is PE ratios go from low to high. So as they go from low to high, a stock is going from cheap to expensive, right? But when they go negative, it's actually closer to a really high PE than it. The problem we have with PEs, and that's why we can't compute a negative PE. A negative PE is actually a really low number, but it's not a really cheap stock. It's a really expensive stock. I know it sounds abstract. But when you flip it around, an earnings to price ratio, you can actually use a negative number. It actually is okay because it is continuous. I'd rather have a high earnings to price ratio than a low earnings to price ratio, and a low earnings to price ratio over a negative earnings to price ratio. So if I rank companies based on earnings to price, I'm actually getting a sensible ranking. Whereas if I rank them based on PE and I leave the negative P's, I get a very strange ranking. So the earnings to price ratio is just the inverse of the PE. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to switch your brains around. You want, as an investor, high earnings to price means you're getting stocks really cheap. So there's the brown line is the earnings to price ratio over time. So you can see in the 1970s, the earnings to price ratio is increasing. That means you're getting stocks really cheap. You're getting them at 8 times earnings, 7.5 times earnings, 6 times earnings. Right next to it, you see a blue line, that's your T-bond rate. You look across much of the history, you can see that until about 5 years ago, the two almost move in lockstep. What I mean by that is T-bond rates go up, earnings to price ratios go up. T-bond rates come down, earnings to price ratios come down. T-bond rates go up again, earnings to price ratios go up. You don't need to do any statistics even to figure out that the two move together. You think, what the heck is this purple line? That's actually the difference between the T-bond rate and the T-bill rate. What am I measuring with that? And I take the T-bond rate and the T-bill rate and I take the difference. What am I measuring? I'm measuring the slope of the yield curve. So why do you care? Because historically in the U.S., it seems to have mattered. The key word is historically. Until 2009, it mattered. And here's why it seemed to matter. When the number was a big positive number, in other words, T-bond rate, the yield curve was upward sloping, markets liked that. As yield curves became flat or downward sloping, P/E ratios came down. Markets didn't seem to like that. We'll come back and talk about why that might be. But that's what the graph tells you. So there's this pre-2009 very strong interest rate effect on PE ratios, and post-2009 something is clearly starting to come apart. So I ran a regression first through the 2008 data. So basically I said, what if I ignore the 2009 to the 2015 period? And here's what the numbers look like. Every 1% increase in the T-bond rate increased the earnings to price ratio by 0.70%. So I know you've got to flip it around in your head. So interest rates go from 3 to 5%. Your earnings to price ratio goes up by 1.4%, which means your price earnings ratio comes down. Every 1% increase in the slope of the yield curve reduces my earnings to price ratio, which basically means my PE ratio goes up. So let's pause and think about why that might be. Why did the market like upward sloping yield curves so much pre-2008? How did yield curves become flat or downward sloping? Go back and look at the graph. You'll see that I'll give you the years when yield curves were downward sloping, and you can start thinking about what the story is. There's 1974, there's 1979, there's 1989, there's 2000. Basically, you got every recession hit there, right? So in other words, you got downward sloping yield curves just before the economy goes into recession, and it's not accidental. The way yield curves have become downward sloping in the U.S. is not because long-term rates have collapsed. It's because short-term rates have popped up. This is the Fed effect historically. The Fed effect shows up in the short end of the curve because what does the Fed control? The Fed funds rate, which is an overnight rate. So they have the most influence on the short end of the spectrum. So historically, yield curves have become downward sloping when the Fed hits the brakes and short-term rates climb. And historically, the economies listen to the, markets at least have believed that there is a real economic effect. So when the Fed has hit the brakes, PE ratios come down, saying, hey, this is bad for real economic growth. The Fed is tightening up money supply. Let's lower stock prices. Whereas an upward sloping yield curve is the Fed is pumping money into the economy. But that's until 2008. For the last 5 years, when you start adding the data in each year, in fact, up till 2008, the R-squared I got was about 51%. 51% of variation in PE ratios for U.S. stocks was explained by movements in interest rates. You didn't even need to bring in anything else. Since then, every year that I add data, it's one more year of data. My R-squared drops by about 2% each year. In other words, what's happened since 2009 is either there is no Fed effect or the market stopped believing that there's a Fed effect, and B, the T-bond rate effect on interest rates seems to have on PE ratios seems to have gone away. In other words, once you get past 2009 or 2010, and part of the reason might be once you get close enough to zero, it might not have the same effect it did as you went from 5 to 4, 4 to 3. You might have hit a point where interest rates are not working at making the market going. And incidentally, if you look at Japan, this happened about 20 years ago. And it's a scary place to be because it basically means that central banks no longer have much effect on stock prices. And that's one source of comfort investors have. In worst case scenario, the Fed's going to come bail us up. And what the 2009 data is suggesting is you might be looking to the wrong place to be safe because it doesn't seem to be happening anymore. But if you look at earnings to price ratios and interest rates, the historic relationship between earnings to price and interest rates, which is a very strong one, has started to fray. And the question is it a temporary period? And 2009, I'd have said, it'll bounce back. It was a crisis last year. 2010, you could still have held on to it. But this is 2015. It's 6 years into the process. Maybe we have to start asking. Maybe the game started to change. There are models out there that are actually built on relationship between earnings to price ratios and interest. There's the model called the Fed model, which actually just compares the earnings to price ratio to the T-bond rate to make judgments. So should you be in stocks? It was based on the fact that historically it did okay because it comes from that pre-2008 data. But if you follow the Fed funds model now, you might be going down the wrong path because it's no longer working, at least within the data. It could come back. I don't know. But at least it's been 7 years, and it looks like it gets weaker and weaker each year that you add another year of data. Any questions? So that's the PE ratio, and you can see how working with those mechanics allows you to kind of disentangle what drives PE ratios. Let's talk about PEG ratios. Again, remember how when we said you have an equity multiple where we say go back to the simplest equity valuation model, which to me is a two-stage dividend discount model. You're saying, why two-stage? Because almost by definition, we're talking about PEG ratios, it can't be a stable growth model. Why not? Because in stable growth models, growth doesn't vary very much across companies, so we have to introduce that front end of a growth rate. So I just the PE, and then I divided the PE. So basically, I went through two layers of algebra. And this is what I ended up with is my equation for the PEG ratio. Remember again, why am I using PEG ratios? Because I'm trying to make growth go away. I'm trying to neutralize the effect of growth by bringing into the equation. Let's see if, in fact, I succeeded. Here's the intrinsic PEG ratio. If you ask me what drives the PEG ratio, it's driven by cost of equity, payout ratio, and expected growth. Same three variables that drive PE. But unlike PE, where I can tell you which direction the relationship is with each variable, with PEG ratios, I start running into trouble. I'll tell you the two easy ones. As risk increases, PEG ratios go down. So for the same level of growth, lower PEG ratios. That was easy. As return on equity increases, PEG ratios go up. As growth increases, I have no idea what will happen to PEG ratios. And that's the most dangerous place to be, because growth is in the numerator. It's all over the place. If you're using PEG ratios to make growth, this is a very strange way to make growth go away, because you've got growth up there, growth down here, growth as a squared, all over the place. And it shows up when you create these hypothetical examples. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the same example I used to illustrate PE ratios, and I'm going to show you what will happen to PEG ratios as I change the beta, as I change the return equity, and as I change growth. And when you see what happens to PEG ratios as I change growth, you're going to see why I'm so worried about using PEG ratios to pick stocks. So if I hold all else constant, let's start with the easy ones. As risk goes up, PEG ratios go down. So if I am not careful and I'm comparing PEG ratios across stocks, and I try to get you to buy low PEG ratio stocks, and I don't control for risk, I'm going to end up with a lot of very risky stocks in my portfolio. Okay? So when you divide PE by the growth rate, if you're telling me it's because growth goes away, it doesn't go away. In fact, it shows up in every single input, and here's how I'm going to show it. I'm going to take the same example I used for my PE ratio. 5-year growth period, 25% growth rate, so all the same inputs. I come up with a PEG ratio for this company. So I just plug the numbers into that big equation. And the intrinsic PEG ratio for this company, if you believe all my inputs, is about 1.15. This company's PE should be higher than its growth rate, which already casts as a lie this rule of thumb that a PEG ratio above 1 is overvalued. Depends on the company. This company at 1.15 times growth is actually at a reasonable, at a fair level, PEG ratio. I went in and I changed just the beta. So this is the same growth rate. Everything about this company stays the same. But I try betas of 0.751, 1.1, and you can already see that as my risk goes up, the PEG ratio for this company goes from 2 times, so from 2, all the way down to 0.4. And that's what I meant about being careful about comparing PEG ratios across companies and not adjusting for risk. I've seen tech company equity research reports where the analyst compares the PEG ratio of the tech company to the PEG ratio for the S&P 500. You know why that doesn't work? The tech company is riskier than the S&P. It should look cheaper. If you want to compare the tech company's PEG ratio, you have to compare it to other companies of equivalent risk. Because if you don't control for risk, risky companies are going to look cheaper on a PEG ratio basis. I change the return equity, which is the same thing as doing the payout ratio. And again, higher return equity, higher PEG ratio. So again, if you give me a company with a really low PEG ratio and tell me it's cheap, I'm going to ask you, how risky is it? What kind of return equity did it make last year? Because 9 times out of 10, it's either going to be a very risky company or a company with a terrible return equity. But this is the graph that worried me. So here's what I did. I kept everything else fixed, and I changed just the expected growth rate during the next 5 years. Initially, as I changed growth, my PEG ratio decreased. It decreases because of a very simple reason. My value doesn't increase proportionately with my growth. So as I go from 1% growth to 5 to 10 to 15, the value is not changing proportionately. So it's purely a present value effect kicking in. So if you're not careful, that low PEG ratio company might actually be a company that has a really high growth rate that you just accidentally picked as your cheap company. But there is a certain growth rate at which it starts to work in the other direction. See why this is problematic? Remember that perfect cheap company asked you to pick a PE, low PE, high growth, low risk, high return equity. I mean, even though there's a very low chance you could find it, we knew what we were looking for. So let's say you're in Yahoo Finance or Capital IQ, and you're going to use PEG ratios to screen for cheap companies. So first, you're going to screen for companies with low PEG ratios. Let's make it less than 0.8. So we get a list of companies. Then you remember, oh, I don't want risky companies, so you have a screen for risk. It could be debt to equity, standard deviation. You want to pick companies with low risk. So you've got low PEG ratios, low risk. Then you screen for return equity. You want high return equity, you screen for 20% more or more. You get the third screen. And then I ask you, what do you want to do with growth? You want to screen for low growth or high growth? Because, and you can see that it can cut in both directions, right? Both, if you look at PEG ratios are actually lowest in the middle of your growth spectrum. They're really high at either end. So you want to actually avoid companies which have growth rates around the middle? Is that so? How do we screen for that? Get rid of all the average growth companies, leave the high growth and low growth companies? It's a mess. Screening with PEG ratios, especially when it comes to growth, can be messy because we don't know which direction the relationship is going to be depending on where we are in the graph. So that's my reason for saying be careful with PEG ratios. You never know what you're going to find because of that growth problem. So here are my basic propositions with PEG ratios. First is, if you don't control for risk, high-risk companies will always look cheap on a PEG ratio basis. High-risk sectors will always look cheap relative to low-risk sectors. Okay? Second, if you can grow more efficiently, earn a higher return on equity, I would expect you to have a higher PEG ratio than if you don't. So companies that have terrible returns on equity will look cheap on a PEG ratio basis. And third, with growth, companies with very low or very high growth will tend to have higher PEG ratios than companies with growth in the middle. So again, if you think you're eliminating growth by using PEG ratios, think again. You're just moving it all over the place. You're making the relationship a really messy one. Okay. Oh, incidentally, on PEG ratios, about a while back, probably a decade ago, one of the investment banks, Quant Team, ran this study on PEG ratios, and they came to the conclusion that PEG ratio investing was great because it delivered a return 3% higher than the S&P 500. So basically, they went back over time. They screened for the 100 stocks with the lowest PEG ratios each year. They didn't control for risk, nothing. They just compared the returns on those 100 stocks relative to the returns in the S&P 500 and said, look, it works. If you just pick stocks with the lowest PEG ratios, you will beat the market by 3%. Now, you can see already what the problem of that study is, right? So about 2 years after the study is done, people start finding out that they followed the strategy and all the stocks in their portfolio, these incredibly risky stocks. So they complained to the investment bank saying, hey, what do you lead us into? You didn't tell us that you're going to end up with risky stocks. So the investment bank went back to the drawing board and decided to tweak the ratio to make the problem go away. What I mean by that, right now it's giving you all these risky stocks. They want to deliver more stocks. So here's what they did. They took the PEG ratio and divided that number by the dividend yield. What do you get with that? They called it a PEGI ratio. It's price earnings divided by growth plus dividend. The things that people will do. I mean, if you think PEG ratios are a mess, try PEGI ratios. Try writing the equation, and after about 3 pages of algebra, you're just going to give up. Okay? But what they were trying to say was, if we can bring in high dividend yield into the denominator, then we're going to tilt it back towards safer stocks. They ended up with this complete mess of a screen because you were getting some really big dividend-paying utilities and some really risky technology companies in there. But the problem is they were trying to get everything into the multiple. They wanted the multiple to do all the dirty work of controlling for growth and controlling for risk, and that's it. You know, it's not going to work. Okay. Question back there. The question? Okay. Oh.
So when the G is really large, as it was in the previous chart, it becomes like bigger than the R. So you
get you don't use an infinite growth model, right? Basically, it's a two-stage growth model. So if you look at that equation, this G can be greater than the R in the high growth period. In fact, it is. But it's going to be okay because when this G is greater than the R, this number is going to be a negative number. So that's why a perpetual growth annuity works, where the growth rate be any number. It's this growth rate that cannot be greater than the cost of equity. And that never will because that's a stable growth model. It's just the first. It's this first growth rate. Never mess with this growth rate because it's a stable growth rate of the economy. So that's why I needed a two-stage model to bring that in. Okay. Any other questions on PEG ratios or PEGI ratios? So now let's talk about price-to-book ratios. Okay. Price-to-book is an equity multiple too, so might as well go back to a stable growth dividend discount model and start doing the algebra. So divide both sides by the book value. You end up with a price-to-book ratio for a stable growth dividend-paying firm. And I'll give you the four variables that drive the price-to-book. Three are going to look very familiar, and they should start looking very familiar because they're going to show up with every equity multiple. The fourth variable is the new variable that pops up. The price-to-book ratio for a stable growth dividend-paying firm is a function of its cost of equity, its expected growth rate, its payout ratio. So far, those three variables showed up with PE ratios and PEG ratios as well. See the new variable that pops up from the algebra? It's going to be the return on equity. High return on equity companies holding all else constant will have high price-to-book ratios. Low return on equity companies will have low price-to-book ratios. In fact, I'm going to simplify this equation even more. Remember when we talked about fundamental growth, we wrote the growth itself as a function of the return equity? Do you remember what that equation was? That the growth was equal to 1 minus the payout ratio times return equity? If I plug that back into the previous page, I end up with a price-to-book ratio for a company that is actually even simpler than that stable growth model. The price-to-book ratio for a company is the return equity minus the growth rate in the numerator and the cost of equity minus the growth rate in the denominator. So think of what I've just said. If for a company to trade at book value, what has to be true about its return equity? I mean, return equity has to be equal to the cost of equity. That's it. If your return equity is equal to your cost of equity, you're going to trade it. It's an incredibly powerful output because it means you have banks. Right? Let's say you take regulated utilities, and let's say that the regulators actually mean what they say, which is, we're not going to let you earn more than the cost of equity. You know what the value per share should be for Con Ed? It should be whatever the book value of equity per share is. If you believe that banks are in this business where they're going to earn roughly their cost of equity over the long term, hey, don't pay more than book value of equity for JP Morgan. It's actually the driving force between price-to-book ratios. To trade it above book value, your return equity has to be greater than the cost of equity. In fact, banks collectively have a problem. The problem right now is collectively they trade at less than book value. Across, if you take the big money center banks collectively, the price-to-book ratio is less than one. Their actual return equity is actually higher than the cost of equity. If you take the net income from last year and divide by the book equity. But before you get too excited and put all your money in banks, you know what the market's telling you? We don't trust your net income. After the last 5 years, who can blame markets, right? Because they say, we just know you're a surprise away from taking all your excess returns away, or you're one regulatory action away from it happening. That's one way to think about why some companies traded above book value and others traded below book value. So that's the price-to-book ratio. Let's extend this to enterprise value multiples now. So we've talked about price-earnings, PEG ratios, price-to-book, all equity multiples. We went back to a stable growth dividend discount model. Let's now try enterprise value multiples. To look at an enterprise value multiple, let's say you decide to try enterprise value to invested capital, which is the company analog to a price-to-book ratio. So instead of price, I'm using the enterprise value. Instead of book value of equity, I'm going to use book value of debt plus equity minus cash. I'm going to go back to a stable growth model. And because it's an enterprise value multiple, I use free cash flow to the firm instead of dividends and cost of capital instead of cost of equity. If I work through the algebra, here's what the enterprise value to invested capital multiple is going to look like. It looks very much like the price to book ratio equation, right? Instead of return on equity, you now have return on capital. So cost of equity, you have cost of capital. As you start working with these multiples, that's something that's going to start to stick, is whenever you talk about equity multiples, everything you talk about will be equity driven, return equity, cost of equity, growth in equity earnings. When you start shifting to enterprise value multiples, your language will have to shift as well. Because now we're talking about return on capital, cost of capital, growth in operating income, because you're talking about an enterprise value multiple. But the principles are exactly the same. The algebra is exactly the same. For a company's enterprise value to be much higher than its invested capital number, you've got to earn more than your cost of capital. And remember that lesson we talked about DC evaluation? For growth to have value, you've got to generate more. It's exactly the same lesson played out in the context of multiples, is that's what drives what the market attaches the value to your company. We're almost to the end of the analytics. I know you're getting tired of the algebra, but let's talk about EV to EBITDA multiples. So again, EV is, you know, because EV to EBITDA is a firm multiple, I went back to a firm valuation model. I rewrote the free cash flow to the firm as EBITDA times 1 minus T plus the tax benefit. Trust me, I'm just rewriting the free cash flow to the firm in terms of EBITDA. If I divide both sides of that equation by the EBITDA, I have an EV to EBITDA multiple. So as I go through this, I want you to start thinking about the questions you're going to ask me when I try to sell you something as cheap based on EV to EBITDA. The first factor that drives EV to EBITDA is your tax rate. The higher your tax rate, the lower your EV to EBITDA is going to be. Why didn't tax rates play a role when I did PE ratios? I didn't care what your tax rate was, 12 or 50%. It's not just that. The earnings that I was using were after-tax earnings. So in other words, if you had a high tax rate, your earnings per share already reflected it. Whereas the further you move up the income statement, the more unanswered questions you've left, right? So if you're, I give people the extreme example. Let's suppose you operate in an economy where the government takes away 100% of your earnings. I know it's absurd. You know what you should pay for a company in that country? If the government is actually serious about taking all your earnings away, you should pay nothing. It looked really cheap on an EV to EBITDA basis if I offered you for 3x earnings, but remember, this earnings is before taxes. So the first factor that drives EV to EBITDA is what's your tax rate? So remember, and to me, this is the biggest part of relative valuation, is think of it as questions you're going to ask me when I try to sell you something based on this multiple. So I call you and say, I've got this really good company for it. It's trading at 5x EBITDA. First question is, what was the effective tax rate last year? Second, if you take the three variables up there, CapEx minus depreciation plus change in working capital, that consolidated number is what we call reinvestment when we did discounted cash flow valuation. So the second question you should ask me is, how much did the company reinvest back into the business last year? Because if I'm reinvesting huge amounts back into the business and delivering anemic growth, of course I should trade at 3x EBITDA. That DAR that you were so dazzled about, it's going back into the company in spades because you got this huge CapEx wiping it out. So what kind of reinvestment did you have last year? What was your CapEx? What was your working capital needs? Third question, what's your cost of capital? Are the things remaining equal? Maybe I'm an Argentine company or a Brazilian company with a huge cost of capital, which also pushes down my EV to EBITDA. And the final factor is going to be, what kind of growth can I expect the company? Higher growth companies should have higher EV to EBITDA multiples than lower growth companies. Four questions: tax rate, reinvestment, cost of capital, growth rate. Yeah.
Wouldn't the useful life's depreciation period matter in this as well?
It might, but it'll matter. But if you have the CapEx, that's effectively bringing it in as well, right? Because if you have very short useful life, the way it'll show up is you have lots of CapEx kind of coming in to make up for the depreciation, right? So the useful lives matter only to the extent that you think you can delay the CapEx for a long period. So we'll talk about that, for instance, with trucking companies, where you can make a big CapEx and not have CapEx for 6 or 7 years. You can have this period where EV to EBITDA can go through a cycle. You think you're buying something cheap, when in fact all you're doing is buying the company just before a huge CapEx. So that will factor into your DAR, but bringing in the CapEx will take into account what you will have to put back into the business to keep it going. So here's an example. You have a company, tax rate of 36%, CapEx is 30% of EBITDA, depreciation is 20%, cost of capital is 10%. For simplicity, let's assume no working capital requirements, firm is in stable growth, growing 5% a year. So you give me these numbers and say, what EV to EBITDA should I pay for this firm? Rather than look at comparables, I do an intrinsic EV to EBITDA. I go to the previous page, I look up that equation, I put in the 36% tax rate, 20% depreciation, 36% tax rate, 30% CapEx, no working capital, 8.24x EBITDA. That's an intrinsic EV to EBITDA for this company. You say, why bother? Remember what I did with PE ratios? I changed one variable at a time.
I change the tax rate. And not surprisingly, when my tax rate increases in this example, that 8.24 EBITDA becomes, you know, starts to drop off to less than 6 times EBITDA. If you get a chance, download the EV to EBITDA multiples for telecom companies in Europe and start comparing them across countries, because you have big differences in tax rates. And you're going to find that the high tax rate countries are have the companies that look cheap because they're paying 35% tax rates. If you're not careful, on an EV to EBITDA basis, German telecom companies will look cheaper than Irish telecom companies because you're not factoring the differences in taxes. Second, holding all else constant, if I increase my reinvestment to get the same growth rate, my EV to EBITDA collapses. It's no surprise that EV to EBITDA multiples are lowest in sectors which have horrible returns on capital, but companies keep putting money back into the business. You know why they're targeted by private equity investors? No, actually what they do is they buy it at the low EV to EBITDA. The market is factoring in the huge reinvestment, the low return on capital. And they say, well, there's nothing that tells me that I have to keep reinvesting in these businesses. Let's stop. Right? Because if you stop, what happens then is you get to keep the DA. There's no CapEx. You basically run the company into the ground. But that's okay. Getting out of a bad business is a better value decision than staying in the business. It's no wonder that that is your prime target, especially if you want to add leverage to the mix and get the tax benefits from doing it, because that's effectively what you're counting on for getting increased value. And finally, as I increase my return on capital, my EV to EBITDA will increase as well. So let's think about a perfect undervalued company on an EV to EBITDA basis. So let's start. You want low EV to EBITDA, obviously. You want low tax rate or high tax rate? You want low tax rate, because a high tax rate will explain away the... So you want low EV to EBITDA, low tax rate. Low return on capital or high return on capital? You want a high return on capital because the low... Again, nothing that... So you want low EV to EBITDA, low tax rate, high return on capital. And if you can get a low cost of capital, you'd love to throw that into the mix as well. You get that combination. You've essentially found your perfect company. Again, no harm in looking, right? Keep scanning. You never know what you'll find. So again, if you start breaking EV to EBITDA down, it's just like any other multiple. You can start working out what the variables are. Let's close with revenue multiples. You know, obviously, more and more companies, you see people using revenue multiples. And again, I do the algebra, and I'll save you the trouble of taking you through the algebra, but the variable that pops out when you bring an EV to sales, every multiple, there's a variable that's going to pop out as a new variable. I call that the companion variable. The companion variable in the sense, if you gave me a chance to ask you only one question, that's the one I'm going to focus on. With price to book, it was return equity. With price earnings, it was growth. With any revenue multiple, it's going to be a margin question. High margin companies will trade at high multiples of revenues. Low margin companies will trade at low multiples of revenues. In fact, I'm going to give you a very simple trick for finding the companion variable without doing the algebra. Here's the trick. If you have an equity multiple, to find the companion variable, take your net income and divide it by the denominator of your equity multiple. Okay? So write that down for the moment. We'll try a different one. So with an equity multiple, take net income and divide by the denominator of your equity multiple. You'll get the companion variable for an equity multiple. For an enterprise value multiple, take after-tax operating income, EBIT times 1 minus T, and divide by the denominator of your multiple, and you get the companion variable for an enterprise value multiple. You say, what the heck is he talking about? Let's try this. Take price to book. First, is it equity multiple or enterprise value multiple? It's an equity multiple. So what are we going to do? We're going to divide net income by the denominator, which is book value of equity. What's net income divided by book value of equity? Return equity, price to book ratio, return equity. You have price to sales. I don't like the multiple, but let's say you decide to use it. To get the companion variable, what am I going to do? I'm going to take net income and divide it by sales, which gives me net profit margin. So the companion variable for price to sales is net margin. You're saying, but it doesn't work with PE. Let's see. PE, your denominator is net income. I divide by net income. My net income, I get 1. But what if I take net income in the future and divide by net income today? What do I get then? I get the growth rate. So even with PE, it works. So with equity multiples, you get the companion variable. You divide net income by the denominator. Let's try enterprise value multiples. Let's start with enterprise value to sales. Enterprise value to sales, take after-tax operating income and divide by sales, I get after-tax operating margin. Enterprise value to invested capital. I take after-tax operating income and divide by invested capital, I get return on invested capital. It's a companion. So it's actually a nifty little way of getting that companion variable, saying that's the one number at the minimum I should be controlling for when I compare across companies. So equity multiples divide net income by the denominator, enterprise value multiples after-tax operating income. Yeah.
So this kind of destroys the rationale of people using sales multiples to value tech early stage companies?
Well, it basically means that they have to use some visionary net income. You know what I mean by that target net income that we use? It's not unrealistic because if you're a startup, dividing net income today by the revenue, of course, is going to give you a big negative number. But if you believe that this company is a high revenue growth, high margin company, then you can see that you're back in the game, right? Because then you're saying it's not next year's net income I'm buying it based on. I'm buying it for this net income that it's a lot riskier. So you might have to do some discounting of that number. But it's still within the realm of pricing. It just means that the way you price things is going to be different depending on what variable you're focused on. The young tech companies, the focus shifts away to that forward earnings rather than next year's earnings. And that's why you're not buying these companies for what they will look like a year from now, but hopefully what they will look like 10 years from now.
No one's discounting it back.
Well, that's a different question. If they're discounting, they might not be discounting it back enough. They might not be allowing for the... I don't think it's not that they're discounting. They're not allowing for the survival risk. That's really the problem, is they're putting in this growth rate. They're acting like every company is going to end up succeeding and becoming a high growth company. And that's a macro delusion that I'm talking about. You might be right on individual companies, but collectively you're screwing up because some of these companies are not going to make it, or a big chunk are not going to make it. Right? So that's really the key, is basically you're tying the multiple to something that you can focus on. If it's not next year's number, it's 5 years from now, but the debate then shifts about to whether that number is high enough to justify what you pay. Okay. Now let's talk. In fact, if you want to make this, you say, will it work if I have enterprise value per user? What do I have to do? I have to divide after-tax operating income by number of users. So basically, if this is an after-tax operating, if you're paying $500 per user, the question I'm going to ask you is, show me that you can make a lot of money off your users. If not now, what is the model you have in place where you're going to be selling me $300 of advertising per user? Because only then can I justify what I'm paying up in front. Yeah.
Just looking at like EV to EBITDA.
Yeah.
Does that come out kind of weird?
Does it come out weird? In what way?
So if you
net income divide. Are you saying if I divide after-tax operating income by EBITDA? Well, what are the things that separate the two? Taxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other is the fact that you've got that DAR number, which is part of what you have to reinvest. So indirectly, it's capturing the tax effect and the reinvestment effect. That's what you're capturing by taking the... So numbers, companies where there's a big difference between the EBITDA and the EBIT times 1 minus T, you got to be a lot more careful than companies where there's a small difference. That's why when you have capital-intensive companies that look cheap on an EV to EBITDA basis, when you start comparing the after-tax EBIT to that EBITDA, red flags go up saying, you know, maybe this company is not as cheap as it looks. Now let's use this to do something that pisses marketing people off. But that's why that's the reason for my existence. But it's this issue of brand name. Marketing, it's a huge deal, right? Brand name. In fact, Scott Galloway asked me to come and talk to his L2 conference about 2 years ago. And these are all marketing people in the audience. And I said, are you sure, Scott? Do you really want me to talk to these people? They won't like me after. He said, no, I don't care if they don't like you, and you don't care if they don't like you, so why don't you just come and talk? So I went and talked about the value of a brand name. So let's step back and think about what the value of a brand name. I'm not saying it's no value. What's the value of a brand name? You get to charge a higher price for exactly the same product. You want pure brand name power at play. Here's what I want you to do. Walk over to the local CVS. Walk down the painkiller aisle to the aspirin section.
You're going to see all these bottles of aspirin, right? There's going to be a Bayer aspirin, obviously, there. Right next to Bayer aspirin will be a CVS aspirin. Check the prices out. I did yesterday, and the CVS aspirin is about half the price of a Bayer aspirin. Just to be sure, check out the ingredients. You know what you're going to see? Aspirin's been off patent 100 years, I think. It's exactly the same ingredient. Then ask yourself a final question. Be honest with yourself. How often have you bought the Bayer aspirin over the CVS aspirin, the Sudafed over the generic Sudafed? Because mentally you say, when I take that Sudafed, my allergies seem to go away much faster than when I take the generic version. That's the power of a brand name. Is you get to charge a higher price for exactly the same product. Remember I said every story has a number that goes with it? So if you're getting to charge a higher price for exactly the same product, where am I going to see it in the numbers?
Margin.
I'm going to see it in your profit margin. I'm going to see it as a higher enterprise value to sales ratio. And if you want to isolate the effect of brand name, all you have to do is take that pricing power away and see what the value of this company would be if they lost the margin. In fact, it's a difference between two numbers. The multiple of revenues you pay for this company as a brand name company with its high margins, and the multiple of revenues you would pay for the same company if that margin power went away. So let me take an example. About a decade ago, I went into Coca-Cola to do a valuation of the company for their top management. They said, can you come in and talk about value with us? And I said, sure. I do this at least twice a year. I go to corporates and I talk to them because it gives you some insight into what they're thinking about value. So this was the management team at Coca-Cola, and it included the finance people, the marketing people, the strategy people. They're all in one room, all drinking Coca-Cola. I think that was just for show. They had these cans in front of them. They might have filled it with Pepsi for all I know. Yeah? So I do a traditional DCF valuation. I come up with about $79.6 billion. So this is about a decade ago. I finished the valuation. So I project out cash flows and growth rates and return on capital and reinvestment rates. I finish it, and the guy in the front row, the marketing head honcho, puts up his hand. He says, you forgot something very important. I'm saying, what did I forget? Maybe a whole division, maybe a country, maybe an entire part of the world. So I said, what did I forget? He said, he forgot the fact that Coca-Cola is the most valuable brand name in the world. So what exactly do you want me to do? He said, you should be adding at least 20% to that $79.6 billion. I said, why 20%? He said, because that's what we do at Coca-Cola, is when we buy brand name companies in other countries, we value them, and then we add 20%. He said, just because you do stupid things doesn't mean I have to do stupid things too. He said, don't you think our brand name is worth a lot? I said, sure, but it's already in there. He said, where? Everywhere. Why do you think you earn these margins? Because the soda tastes really good? Dispel with that illusion. It's because... Forget about the syrup and who has the items that go into the syrup. It's because of your brand name you're able to charge these prices. He said, I don't believe you. That's what marketing people do. So this time, I got lucky on this one because I kind of knew this question was going to come up. Because you're going to Coca-Cola, brand name is a fixation. And here I got lucky because I was able to find a company called Cott. It's a Canadian company that makes generic stuff. The reason you've never heard of it is when you walk into a grocery store and pick up that Pathmark soda, and you look at, Pathmark doesn't make soda. It buys the soda from Cott and stamps it as Pathmark. So they sell to companies to put their own names on. They're a non-brand name company. That's what I meant by getting lucky, because in some businesses you can get lesser brand names and bigger brand names, but you won't get a no brand name. And here's what I did. I didn't compare Coca-Cola to Cott. That would be pointless because the company's different size. One is a U.S. company, the other is a Canadian company. I asked a question. If tomorrow we woke up, all collectively, the whole world woke up with selective amnesia, and the only word we did not recognize was the word Coca-Cola and the red can that went with it, what would happen to Coca-Cola? This is every marketing person's nightmare. Let's make it come true. Tomorrow your brand name goes away. Your pricing power is gone. Nobody recognizes it. Your margins are going to drop, right? You're going to become a generic soda company. And guess what? A generic soda company has a margin one-third of yours. I'm going to replace your margin. So this is Coca-Cola with Cott's margins. But the ripple effects are deadly. Because when I lower the margin,
my return on capital goes down because my return on capital is a product of my margin times my turnover ratio. So if I lower the margin, the return on capital goes down. The return on capital goes down with the same reinvestment rate, my growth rate goes down. And if I translate all the effects down, the value that I get for the company without its brand name is $15.4 billion. You want me to add a brand name premium? I just did. I gave you a $64.2 billion premium. You don't think it's enough? Tell me why. But don't ask me to add 20% on top of this number because then I'll be double counting premium. If you've done a good discounted cash flow valuation, it should already be in there. Whatever it is, there's no garnishing allowed in this process where after the fact you start adding 10%, 15%. If you have a story to tell me, tell it to me. And my job is to find a number to put it in. And in most cases, and this is what freaks me out about accountants trying to value brand name. Because it is going to become mechanical. It's going to be rule driven. And there's going to be a number that shows up in balance sheets. And people are going to start adding that number onto a discounted cash flow valuation. And we're going to be double counting and triple counting things we should not be counting. But if you have to value brand name, that's the playbook for doing it. And it's easy with companies like Coca-Cola or Kellogg's. You know why? Because let's be completely honest. There is no high-quality fruit snacks. There's nothing special about a soda. There it's pure brand name driving pricing differences. It's much more difficult if you're looking at what the brand name value is for an apple. Do you see why? Because in addition to brand name, you've got these system differences. I mean, you've got all this other stuff going on. What you're getting is a consolidated value for all your competitive advantages. That's really what you're getting. In the case of Coca-Cola, its only competitive advantage happens to be brand name. Right? And it also means that if Walmart is the company you're talking about, let's not talk about brand name. There's no brand name value there. There are other competitive advantages there. They have economies of scale. Brand name is not the only competitive advantage, and for many companies, it should not be the competitive advantage we think about. It's only for a subset of companies where brand name is a driving factor, and this rubric will work in most of those sectors, though in some, you'll have a tougher time finding the generic company. If you're interested in valuing brand name specifically, I have an extended paper on what to do when you can't find a generic company or how do you control for differences. It's actually a very useful skill to have, even if you decide to go back to marketing, much as I pity your choice. You know, you want to go back to marketing, you want to be the most informed person in the room about brand name value, get the tools ready because we can talk much more sensibly about brand name than just throwing names out. I recognize the name, therefore it must be a brand name. So I'm not going to bore you by determining or going through the algebra of any more multiples. I think you get it by now. What I mean by that is you have an equity multiple, go back to stable growth. It looks like you've had eight equations. You've just had one equation. All I've done is played with the algebra there and come up with drivers for any equity multiple. And you can see the variables that drive all the equity multiples. With enterprise value multiples, I went back to a firm valuation model, came up with the variables that drive whether it's value to EBIT, value to EBITDA, value to sales, value to invested capital. It's all you need is one decent discounted cash flow model with each and some algebra to go with it. And you can tell me what drives any multiple and essentially what questions I should be asking if I find something to be cheap based on that multiple. So define, describe, analyze. We're almost there. Now we can start applying because we've got the variables nailed down. And at this stage, there are two questions we're going to run into. First is, what should I call comparable? Now, I know that you haven't looked at the valuation of the week from yesterday, but here's all I did. I took every company in the healthcare sector on Capital IQ. And healthcare sector includes both pharma, I think there are about 140 pharmaceutical companies, at least according to Capital IQ, and about 350 biotechnology companies. So I created this big Excel spreadsheet. Then I broke them into two groups, the pharma company separately and the biotechnology company separately. And I valued Amgen first as a biotechnology company, and it looks really cheap. And then as a pharma company where it kind of falls in the middle. And you can see it's a judgment, right? Just because it started off as a biotechnology company doesn't mean I have to leave it as a biotechnology company. But it's a judgment call, and that judgment call can very quickly make something look cheap or expensive. It's what you compare it to. And no matter how careful you are about these comparable firms, the reality is that after you're done, you're still going to have differences across the companies, differences in growth and risk and payout and all the rest of the stuff that you can talk about or do something about. So what I want to do is establish a framework for first deciding what you should be using as comparable firms, because that's a big part of pricing. And second, how to control for differences. So when you think about comparables, here's one way to do it. Find one other company out there that looks just like your company. You just compare your company to that company. You think, that is absurd. Who would do that? You know, for 50 years in the automobile sector in the U.S., this is what analysts did. They'd compare GM to Ford and Ford to GM. GM to Ford and Ford. It's amazing. That's all they had to do. You say, GM looks expensive relative to Ford. Okay. As if the whole world revolved. But for them, that's what it was. And their argument was, everything else is different. These are the two companies that just like each other will compare. I've seen analysts compare Facebook to Google, Google to Facebook, because they say there's nothing else on the universe that's quite like it. Okay? So basically, you have this choice of, should I go with a single firm just like mine, a small sample of firms that are very much like mine, or a large sample of firms where I'm giving up? Because in fact, with yesterday when I looked at Amgen, I could have focused on just the 10 largest market cap healthcare companies, more like Pfizer. I said, that's the only group I should be comparing to, because that's where Amgen belongs. Or I could gone to a slightly larger sample of all pharmaceutical companies, all biotech, or all healthcare companies. So each time I do this, I'm making a trade-off. And the trade-off is simply, I'm getting a sample of companies that don't look like my company. But what's the benefit I'm getting when I'm going to a bigger sample? The law of large numbers start to work in my favor. So that's the first decision you got to make. Do you want a small sample of companies just like yours, or a larger sample where you can control for differences better because you've got the law of large numbers? I'll give you my biases. I prefer larger samples over smaller samples because I don't trust myself with small samples not to let my bias get in the way. With larger samples, I know I'll get different companies, but I have the statistical tools to control for those differences. And in terms of comparison, here are the way I can compare. One is, I can try to do direct comparisons between the two companies. Now, you know what? It's higher growth, lower risk. It works when I have only two or three firms, or maybe five firms in my sample. I can try a lot of storytelling. And you've seen this in equity research reports. Higher growth, therefore the PE should be higher. How much higher? Well, just as high enough as it needs to be, so you don't need to be specific. There's a lot. You can modify the multiple, as we did with PEG ratios, try to bring that variable in. Or you can draw on statistics. And as I said, statistics is a tool that was designed for relative valuation. It allows you to control for differences across companies. So we'll end with a couple of very simple examples. Here's the first one. I got fired as the emerging market asset allocator after my decision to push everything into Turkey. So now I've landed on my feet, and I'm now the beverage analyst. And this is my sector. There are my companies. So there's the trailing PE and the, so this is from way back, so don't try to say, well, the PE, so the numbers might not make sense if you compare them to where they are today. So there's the trailing PE, there's the expected growth, there's the standard deviation. There's a reason I've given you all three. So are you ready? I'm going to put out some buy recommendations, and I'd like you to shoot them down. Really, I want you to shoot them down. They're bad recommendations, but I'm going to make it anyway. Okay? I'm going to suggest that you put your money in Andre Wine. You know what Andre Wine produces? Champagne's so cheap that you get a headache just watching that commercial. It shows up only just before Christmas every year. A person in a sleigh drinking Andre wine just before I think they pass out. Right? But it's really cheap wine. So you know why I picked these two, right? If you go back, I should pick Todd Hunter as well. Why not throw that in? So basically, I could put Andre Wine, Todd Hunter, and Hanson, because they're the only companies that trade at less than 10 times earnings. Play devil's advocate. Let's start with the easy ones. What's the problem with Andre Wine and Todd Hunter? Why do they have low P's? Well, the growth is horrible. Yeah. What's the problem with the Hanson? Looks pretty good. The growth is pretty good, but at least in this sample, there is that obvious. You see, everybody would have caught that. You caught that because I threw the extra two columns in there, right? If I just left you with that first column, you'd say, no, you're right, low P's. That's all it sometimes requires to dispel first level mistakes is just collect the data on risk and growth. Even if you decide not to use it, that's okay. So the thing that should worry you here when you look at these companies is there's something. I'm not saying you shouldn't buy Hanson Wine, but you have to think about, why is it riskier? Will the risk dissipate? Am I being compensated enough for that risk when I get the stock at 9.7 times earnings? Second, I get fired as a beverage analyst after I put all of my clients' money into André Wine. So I land on my feet again. Now I'm the telecom ADR analyst. And this is in the late 90s when a lot of privatized telecoms had just gone public. They were listed in the U.S. The advantage of ADRs is, at least in theory, the earnings are all restated using GAAP. So I can compare the P.E. ratios. So I have the P.E. ratios. Again, I'm going to play the role of an equity research analyst and put out a buy recommendation. Saying, put your money in Telebras. Remember, this is late 90s Telebras, when Brazil was a really risky country. 8.9 times earnings. It looks cheap, but here are the things to worry about. One is its growth then was lower than most of the other companies. The other, of course, is it's a risky country, telecom, as opposed to something like Teledenmark, which is a more stable country. So the two things that worry you here are lower growth and higher risk. But what's worrying going to do for you other than create more storytelling? So here's what I did. I ran a regression of P/E ratios in the sector against the growth rate and against a dummy variable. You know what a dummy variable is? You set it to 0 or 1. I set it to 0 if it was a developed market telecom, 1 if it was an emerging market telecom. And here's the way to read the output. First, the R-squared is 66%. That explains two-thirds of the variation. Statistics classes, unfortunately, ruin us for life because everything in statistics classes have R-squareds of 95%. And I'll tell you something. If your R-squared is 95%, you're testing something absolutely not worth testing. Things like, what is the relationship between how much you eat and how much you weigh? It's very strong. Or how many beers you drink and what your GPA is. If you drink more than 50 beers a week, your GPA is in the toilet because you're never getting out of bed. But some R statistics professors think that if they show you R-squareds of 18%, you'll never come back to class. So I feel this. So let me start off by saying in finance, you will never get 95% R-squareds. If you get up to 30%, be happy. 50%, you're dancing in the street. 66%, you're delirious. Right? So this is as good as it's going to get. Every 1% increase in growth in the sector increases my PE by 1.21, so because I'm doing everything in percentage terms. And if you're an emerging market company with the same growth rate as a developed market company, at least in the late 90s, your PE ratio would have been 13.85 lower than mine. That's the discount the market was attaching to emerging market companies. Remember how we did this in DCF valuation? We came up with a rating and a spread and put into the discount rate. This is what the market is attaching. I'm not saying it's the right thing to do, but that's what the market is discounting companies for. And I plug the numbers in for Telebras. Remember at 8.9 times earnings, it looked cheap? And I plug in the growth rate and the fact that it's an emerging market company, my predicted PE for Telebras is actually 8.35. On a risk-adjusted, growth-adjusted basis, Telebras is actually expensive. It's actually surprising how well statistics work. So take the next sector you're interested in, take some multiples, take the variables that you're thinking about, and try running a couple of regressions. See what you get as the relationship, how much of the variation you're explaining, because that will give you at least the starting point for what to do next. So let's stop there. When we continue, we'll go through a few more examples, and then we'll we're pretty close to ending the relative valuation section. Oh, one more thing I forgot. I know you don't want to hear this, but your mystery project was supposed to come to you today. I actually almost have it done, but I will not get it to you till tomorrow. It's not due till 2 weeks from today, right? Which is Wednesday, the 22nd, I think. So I will send you the mystery project. It's not a big deal. It's actually, you know, 3-hour group project. So if you need 3 hours sometime between now and 2 weeks from now to get it done,
So it's a pretty straightforward project, but I will send it to you tomorrow.
Only earn at its cost of equity, then it should be trading at a price to book ratio of 1, right? I think it says that regulators let them earn up to like the cost of capital, not cost of equity. How would that change the...
No, the return, then they're doing the return on capital and the cost of capital, the same thing.
Cost of capital and cost of equity is the same thing?
No, the return on equity is not set to the cost of capital. They say you earn a return on capital equal to the cost of capital. The regulators, when they say you can earn up to the cost of capital, they're using return on capital.
Okay.
You're not using return on
capital. Wait, sorry. I got confused. Can you say it again?
If you use cost of capital, you no longer can talk about return on equity. You're talking about return on capital.
Mm-hmm.
So the regulatory rule is your return on capital has to be equal to your cost of capital.
Okay.
Then you're into, it's not price to book you should be thinking about, it's enterprise value to invested capital.
Thank you.